Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, new Medicare legislation passes with a $400 billion price tag. Who will benefit?
I think it's going to leave poor people in the lurch, and it's just a boondoggle.
Also, just who negotiates most prescription drug prices? Well, four companies most Americans have never heard of.
And women, listen up. We don't speak up when negotiating a new job.
We've heard many stories from people who say, you know, I hired a lot of men and women in this situation. Every man asked for more. None of the women did.
These stories and a doctor's Christmas gift, free eye surgery for those who can't afford it, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has approved significant changes to Medicare. The bill now heads for the White House, and President Bush says he'll sign it. The legislation helps older Americans pay for prescription drugs, and private insurers will be able to compete against Medicare. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says the bill is a win for everyone.
The victory is not for Republicans. The victory is not really for the President of the United States. The victory is not for the Democrats. The victory is for the American people. And it's not just for seniors. It's for those 77 million baby boomers and all of us who will be seniors in the future. This is clearly a victory for the American people.
But opponents of the Medicare reforms are not celebrating. They say drug companies get too much power in the new legislation. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle refused to support the bill.
My father, many, many years ago, admonished me never to put my signature on something I wasn't proud of. Mr. President, I'm not proud of this legislation. I can't put my signature on this bill, and I don't think anyone else should either.
Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy says the bill threatens the traditional Medicare system. The former Soviet Republic of Georgia scheduled a new presidential election to replace Eduard Shevardnadze, who was forced to resign over the weekend. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi.
Georgia's parliament voted unanimously to hold elections on January 4th. Mikhail Saakashvili, the 35-year-old opposition firebrand who led the protest which toppled Shevardnadze, is widely seen as the frontrunner. New elections for president and parliament are crucial for restoring stability in Georgia. The country's interim leader said a review of state finances showed the economy to be in even more desperate shape than originally thought. The new Georgian president will also have to deal with two separatist movements at once. Ex-President Shevardnadze said yesterday that his family had urged him to give up power. The 75-year-old former Soviet foreign minister said he would stay in Georgia. Shevardnadze said he would concentrate on writing his memoirs. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Tbilisi, Georgia.
The U.S. Administrator for Iraq says attacks against United States troops or those of other countries have dropped in the past 2 weeks. But victims of Iraqi insurgent attacks are increasingly likely to be Iraqis who are working with U.S. forces. The chief of the U.S. Central Command, General John Abizaid, says the number of daily attacks on U.S. and other countries' soldiers are down by about half over the past 2 weeks. However, over the weekend, two car bombs exploded outside two Iraqi police stations. An Iraqi police colonel was killed in Mosul on Saturday. Another Iraqi police chief was killed in a Baghdad suburb on Sunday. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 2 points at 97.49. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 3 at 19.50. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the economy grew at an even faster pace than expected during the third quarter. The Commerce Department says the gross domestic product, the total measure of goods and services within the United States, expanded at a rate more than double the previous quarter. Corporate profits were also up. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The government's latest numbers show the economy growing at a blistering pace during the third quarter. For the 3 months ending in September, the economy expanded at an 8.2% annual rate. The government revised upwards its initial estimate of growth, which had been at 7.2%, based on more complete information. Both personal spending and investment by businesses showed signs of picking up. Especially heartening to economists were double-digit increases in business spending. Corporate profits also rose by more than 10%. Spending by consumers continued to hold up, though much of that may have been fueled by tax cuts, and most economists expect growth to slow some in the final months of the year. Still, the data is good news in terms of where the economy is headed. It was the fastest growth rate for the U.S. economy in nearly two decades. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Wireless phone companies say business is heavy. Thousands of cell phone users are taking advantage of new federal rules letting them keep their cell phone number but switch cell phone service providers. The biggest mobile phone carrier in the country, Verizon Wireless, says it had twice its usual traffic within its stores yesterday. The second largest carrier, Singular Wireless, says parts of its website were down yesterday as it adjusted to the heavy demand of users. It's not yet clear how many people are switching. The rule affects the nation's 100 largest cell markets. Rural carriers are still asking to stop the change. This is NPR News.
The NPR Shop features a variety of NPR clothing selected especially for public radio listeners of all ages and sizes at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Today, the U.S. Senate passed a bill to reform Medicare. It will cause Medicare's unraveling, as Senator Ted Kennedy puts it, or it will modernize it, the words of President George Bush. So, which is it? We asked some seniors in Brookline, Massachusetts this morning.
Kennedy says one thing, another guy says another thing, and I don't know who to believe. But I see on TV that a lot of the seniors are giving the AARP a lot of hell. So I'm leaning towards the seniors. So I'm thinking it's not that great.
What do you think about the plan that Congress is passing right now?
Better than nothing.
I think it's horrible.
Tell me about that.
They don't seem to know how to take care of prescription drugs. I think it's going to leave poor people in the lurch, and I never was in favor of prescription drug plan through Medicare anyway, because I think it's just a boondoggle.
I was trying to understand it, but it's so confusing that I didn't succeed yet. I hope I will. We'll see.
Well, you're not alone. Seniors we spoke with today in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Well, joining us on the line to hopefully untangle some of that confusion, health policy expert Ken Thorpe. Ken teaches at Emory University in Atlanta. Welcome, Professor Thorpe.
Well, thanks. Good to be with you.
Is this bill the end of Medicare as we know it or a bright new beginning?
Well, it's to be seen. It's certainly a major change in the program.
Yep.
Adding prescription drugs is a key component of this, and that's really what most people thought they were doing.
Yeah, the bill will significantly change Medicare in all sorts of ways, but especially by adding that drug benefit, $400 billion at least over the next 10 years for that. Even though 86% of seniors in a recent survey said they were perfectly happy with the drug coverage they have right now. But be that as it may, Ken, explain to us what the donut hole is in this drug coverage.
Well, the bill that was passed will pay for a certain amount of prescription drugs after you pay $250 in coverage. But then there's a lot of money that people would have to spend, starting at about $2,500 a year, where the recipient would have to pay all those dollars out of pocket. So, this debate has really developed a very strange benefit where for some portions of your expenditures, the beneficiary pays for all of it. And once you hit real high expenditures, Medicare pays for all of it. And in between, there are times when the beneficiary, again, has to pay for the entire bill. This resembles nothing at all that's on the market today. So I think one of the things to see is how surprised particularly middle-income seniors are going to be who don't have drug coverage when they actually see what this drug benefit is.
We've heard a lot about privatization, Ken, too. But privatization doesn't kick in till 2010, right? What is the privatization of Medicare as the bill stands now?
Well, this issue of privatization was the major philosophical debate that went on over this bill. What it means is that many who supported the bill want to have traditional Medicare directly compete with private HMOs and other types of managed care plans.
Mm-hmm.
That is new. The concern is that if the HMOs can attract healthier patients or do a better job of controlling cost, that it will make it more expensive for seniors to stay in their traditional fee-for-service Medicare program.
And none of that even starts till 2010, right, and then only experimentally in six cities?
Exactly. That was the compromise. The original bill provision in the House would have had that, you know, virtually universal throughout the country, but now they've watered it down to be six demonstration sites.
Didn't Congress try expanding the role of private insurers before? It was called Medicare Plus Choice. It passed in 1997, and thousands of seniors wound up losing their coverage when HMOs dropped out of Medicare.
Well, that's right. Costs were rising, but at the same time, to balance the budget, Medicare limited the amount of money they paid to the HMOs, so their profit margins fell, and they left the market, and it left a lot of seniors confused and upset.
But what about PPOs, preferred provider organizations, where people choose from a wider network of doctors and hospitals than HMOs? What's their significance in this new bill?
PPOs are more expensive than HMOs. Their costs are higher. And at least to date, they have not found it profitable to enter the Medicare program. So one of the very controversial aspects of this bill was, in order to make it economically feasible for the PPOs to enter, the Congress added $12 billion worth of spending to subsidize the PPOs to make it economically feasible for them to come in. You know, those types of sweeteners have been one of the things that Senator Kennedy in particular has said that the Medicare legislation has in it that perhaps could have been better spent shoring up that drug benefit itself.
Ken, what do you make of the fact that none of this starts till 2006, well after the next presidential election?
That's going to be another tough thing to explain to seniors. There's been a lot of coverage and hoopla about this. But again, in order to make to make the numbers work, we had $400 billion to spend. That means that we had to wait 2 years before it even starts. So I think a lot of seniors are going to be expecting, once this bill is signed, to sign up for a new drug benefit. They're going to have to wait 2 years.
Ken Thorpe is chairman of the Health Policy Department at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And Ken, thanks a lot for joining us on this.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, early on, the thing everyone agreed on was that Medicare reform must provide a prescription drug benefit for the elderly. And in crafting the new legislation, the pharmaceutical industry stood firm on another point. The strong-arming government must not be allowed to negotiate prices. So who will? Four companies most Americans have never heard of. Joining us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Robert Blendon, a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. And, Professor, as I understand it, these four companies act as the middleman between the pharmaceutical companies and insurance plans and others, correct?
Absolutely. Your employer or the insurance company you have for your health insurance negotiates with them to get discounts on the drugs you buy and to administer the benefit from the pharmacy when you go in there or versus a mail order. But they do all the intermediate work for you once you've bought a health insurance policy that covers drugs.
And so couldn't they conceivably, let's say if a health insurance company gives them a fixed amount of money to go negotiate with the drug company, they could conceivably negotiate a real huge discount, and then they would make the difference.
There's no question that they make profits from the discounts they do. Because there are four of them, you have a certain amount of competition that the insurer or your employer can change companies if it looks like that they're really, you know, charging them a lot more. But there's no question that these people are making money. The companies find ways to get discounts and rebates and everything. So they've turned out to be very profitable companies in the business of trying to get discounts for employers and for people who are enrolled in their plan.
How else do they make their money?
These firms also have a mail order business. About 18% of all pharmaceuticals in the country today are actually delivered to people's homes. So they make the money that you would get if you were going to a local drugstore. And then they get a fee from administering the benefit. And if they can keep the cost of the benefit low, they get a larger profit.
You mentioned the mail order businesses that some of these companies have. And we've spoken to pharmacists who are very upset about this. They feel that these people who originally were supposed to act as the middleman are encouraging consumers to buy through the mail order rather than through the pharmacy.
There's absolutely no question. This is a business which does better if you switch over from the local pharmacy and start getting your prescription drugs delivered to your home. They don't have to pay for any of the costs. They keep the management fee. So there's no question these companies are in the business of if it makes sense for you to do more mail order to do that. And they're also in the business of trying to get you to switch to some lower cost drugs. If they're able to get a better deal on it, they make more money. So in both cases, the local pharmacy doesn't like it. Plus, they end up paying the local pharmacy a lower fee for filling the prescription than most normal business clients they have. And so the pharmacists are very threatened by these companies.
Well, and these companies played a huge role in drafting the current legislation. And as we've just seen, they may benefit from a lot of this legislation. Who oversees them?
Well, the federal government is going to have regulation under the Medicare law, and then the state attorney general in every state is responsible, because they're a form of insurance, of overseeing this. And in fact, in New York State, the attorney general is having a major investigation of some of the business practices and rebates from pharmaceutical companies that have been going on. But it's the attorney general of every state for you and I that are employed. And for people who retired, there will be an oversight by the federal government. Whether or not it's adequate or not, I think, is one of the controversies of the recent bill.
And by the way, name the companies for us.
The three largest are Express, Medco, and Advanced PCS. They're sort of the dominant ones. There would be names that people would not be familiar with, because you actually don't hold their card. What you have is your insurer's card. They just manage it on their behalf.
And right now they handle all of the prescriptions for the most Americans, and they're going to take most
of the
elderly.
Retirees, absolutely. So they are going to be the dominant intermediaries for prescription drugs. And the big debate was whether or not it would be better to have government deal directly with the pharmaceutical industry the way Medicare does with doctors and hospitals, or have these private companies be the ones to do it. And that's really what the bill settled. These private companies will be the ones that retirees deal with. They'll administer the benefit, not Medicare or the federal government.
Do you think, in your learned opinion, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
This is a big debate. Government, with its power, could get seniors lower prices. But at the same time, they might depress spending for research for pharmaceuticals in the future, the search for the new Alzheimer's drug, the heart disease drug. But there's no question that government, because it is so large and there's not four of them and they can make one decision, they could probably get seniors a lower price for the drugs they get. But the price would be of government being involved in the future of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, Professor Blendon, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Robert Blendon teaches at the Harvard School for Public Health in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, just ahead, if you don't negotiate, that is, ask for more money on your first job, it adds up to about $500,000 lost by the time you retire. We'll discuss why women don't ask for raises and other facts about women in the workplace.
And later in the program, mystery writer Elizabeth Peters researches her favorite subject.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Let's face it, men do it better and more often than women. Well, at least according to the new book, Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. Men are four times more likely to initiate negotiations, which translates into higher salaries and job promotions. And the authors say if you don't negotiate on the first salary at a new job, by the age of 60, you can kiss more than $500,000 goodbye. Joining us in the studio to talk about women and negotiations and the money they stand to gain or lose because they can't negotiate is Sara Lashever, co-author of Women Don't Ask. Hello.
Hi.
And we're also joined on the phone from her office in Westboro, Massachusetts by Mara Aspinall, president of Genzyme Genetics. Hi, Mara.
Good to speak to you.
Mara, stay right there. Sarah, first of all, explain that math to us. If you don't negotiate on that first salary, $500,000 is lost?
Well, let me give you an example. Say two people at 22 are offered $25,000 starting salary. One negotiates and raises it to $30,000. One doesn't. Even if they get identical 3% increases for the rest of their careers, if the person who negotiated that extra $5,000 simply banks the difference, the greater amount he or she earns, in an account earning as little as 3%, that will have accumulated to $586,000 at retirement.
Reading this book is in part to get a stomachache because you realize the times you did these stupid things. Give us some more of those little alarming statistics.
Well, my co-author, Linda Babcock, is an economist at Carnegie Mellon, and she did several studies. She looked at MAs graduating from the public policy school there and looked at who had negotiated their starting salaries and who had not. And eight times as many men had negotiated their starting salaries as women. Only 7% of the women had done so.
Mara, president of Genzyme, huge company. Does this feel familiar to you? Women especially are not negotiating.
I think the women who have succeeded, and as well as the men, have actually taken a much more proactive role and taken the initiative to negotiate.
Right.
However, I think it is much tougher because of societal issues, I believe, for women to take that initiative and begin the negotiation process.
Well, Sara, you looked into that. Why is it that, as you write, women say negotiating is like going to a dentist, men say it's like winning a ball game? They love it.
Well, there are basically two causes. One has to do with the socialization of children, how we raise little girls and boys, and the other has to do with the kinds of behavior we tolerate and accept in women as adults. You know, all the anxiety, all the socialization that women bring into adulthood about, you know, being modest, not being show-offy, not being conceited, combined with watching other aggressive women or women who are perceived to be aggressive getting, you know, pushed back or ostracized or not getting what they want, makes women feel a large sense of risk around being too direct about their ambitions or their desires.
And what I see is that women also, in general, have a trust in the system alone. Sarah talks about it.
Are we foolish?
Women think that life is a meritocracy, and I think when we're children, we're all taught that, you know, this is the land of opportunity. If you're talented and you do a good job, you'll get ahead. And, you know, males seem to learn a lot earlier than women, or, you know, that's not completely true, that you really have to hustle to get what you want.
And that in doing that, you don't have to apologize for doing so. What I see is even women who are empowered will still apologize for asking for something that is rightfully theirs or information they should know.
And we should say immediately that we know that there are men who have not gotten what they deserved in the workplace. We understand that. But these statistics just don't lie about the disparity between men and women. And not just in the workplace, as you write, this unwillingness to negotiate, to ask for something they want, starts in the home.
Yes. Statistics show that even women who work full-time still do two-thirds of the housework and child care at home.
One of the things that I found very telling is that in individual negotiation situations, women were often just as effective as accomplishing their goals once they began the process. And I think what the book finds very interesting and instructive is to understand the fear of not asking. And getting over that fear achieves so much just by getting into the negotiation and achieving some measure of success in any way by doing that negotiation.
Well, Sarah, let's talk about some of the suggestions that you offer in your book. So how do you go about it? Because, you know, a lot of people might be empowered by hearing this or enraged by hearing the statistics, but then what do you do?
Well, there are several things we recommend. One is just for women to look around and start thinking about the world as a more negotiable place. In other words, look for more opportunities. The second thing that we strongly urge is for women to do their research, to find out what the market value of their skills is. And there are a lot of ways to do that. They can use their social and professional networks. They can look in trade journals. There are a lot of industry and trade journals that will give that kind of information. And there's a lot of information on the web. There are sites like jobstar.org and salaries.com where you can type in what you do, your years of experience, your zip code, and it will tell you the range of pay for that job in your area. So if you're well armed with what you know people get paid, that's going to give you more confidence out of the gate.
And I think for most negotiations, it's not a one-time game. If you do this appropriately and ask for what you need, even if you don't get it then, you have set an important precedent that says, I am thinking about more than what you're just putting out on the table. I am going to look at it, consider it, and decide what is appropriate.
Right. There are a couple of things. One thing is we recommend that women plan to go four rounds, as in, this is what I want. Expect the other person to say, I can't do that much. Say, well, how close can you come to that? And when he or she responds, say, well, you know, let's talk about it a little more. Can we split the difference? Not to concede immediately if you meet resistance, because women do tend to do that more than men. The other thing is that I think this speaks to what Mara was just saying, that by negotiating in a constructive way, by framing it as a let's work this out so we can all be most productive, you preserve long-term relationships. You start things off and we're both on the same side. I want to help you do your job. Well, I want to do my job in the best way possible. And that is much more effective in preserving long-term relationships than going at it in a, you know, competitive, threatening, zero-sum, right. You know, you give it to me or I'm out of here.
Or tone. Keeping it all to yourself and sulking in the corner of your cubicle.
Absolutely.
There's never any upside to that.
Well, I want to thank you both. It is a terrific book.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Robin.
Mara Aspinall, president of Genzyme Genetics, and Sara Lashever, co-author of the book Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a group of Yale law students prepare to sue Yale New Haven Hospital for allegedly harassing patients to pay their bills.
And an eye surgeon offers a holiday special, free care to patients who can't pay.
And we ask mystery author Elizabeth Peters why we're still so intrigued by the ancient Egyptians and their culture.
It's different enough to be fascinating. The mummies, the beautiful jewelry and so forth, and yet you recognize so many human traits in them.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Large explosions have been heard in central Baghdad at this hour. A U.S. military spokesman says he's heard the blast, but says, quote, "We don't know anything yet." Meanwhile, Iraqis report more raids by U.S. forces. The 4th Infantry Division says it has detained 18 Iraqis during 200 raids over the past 24 hours. The raids were carried out in an area north of Baghdad where the division patrols. A sweeping Medicare reform bill is now headed to President Bush, and he has promised to sign it into law. The Senate voted today 54-44 to pass the $400 billion measure, providing the biggest changes to the program in decades. The plan gives seniors a new prescription drug benefit and gives private insurers a larger role in health care for older Americans. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who is also a doctor, says it will provide greater access to preventative care.
This bill is epical in the sense that it modernizes Medicare to 21st century standards, such as preventive care for things like heart disease and diabetes.
Democratic opponents, including Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle, says he did not see many seniors lobbying for passage of the bill.
What you saw instead were lobbyists packing the hallways, lobbyists representing drug companies and insurance companies, who all are obviously quite pleased with this result. They'll do well. Our seniors will not, and that's why this fight must go on.
Senator Ted Kennedy says the measure threatens the Medicare system, and he vows to fight provisions of the bill in future elections and in Congress. The latest United Nations report on aid shows it's still a growing problem. Karen Sloan is in London.
Up to 46 million people around the world are living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and the epidemic shows no signs of slowing despite international efforts to halt its progress. Peter Piot is executive director of UNAIDS.
More people than ever have become infected with HIV, 5 million this year alone, up from 4.8, and that more people than ever have died also from AIDS. 3 million have died.
Piot unveiled his agency's annual report ahead of World AIDS Day, December 1st. The report finds in the U.S. half the 40,000 or so new infections each year are now occurring among the African-American population, particularly among women. Karen Sloan, London.
On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 4 points at 97.44. NASDAQ up a point at 19.48. And the S&P 500 is also up a point at 10.53. You're listening to Here and Now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Poor people, unable to pay their hospital bills, allegedly harassed to the point of losing their homes, their wages garnished. That's what a class action lawsuit in the works in Connecticut is about. The twist is that the case is also something of a family feud at Yale University. Yale Law School students represent the plaintiffs. The defendant is Yale New Haven Hospital, Yale Medical School's teaching hospital. Well, joining us is Andrew Sackett, who's part of the Yale Law School team. And hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Andrew, give me an example of the kind of allegedly aggressive billing practices this lawsuit's all about.
Sure. One of our clients is named Gladys Concepcion, and in the late 1980s, her son was injured very seriously, and she had insurance, but it wasn't enough to cover the bill. The bill was upwards of $70,000. Mm-hmm. Her insurance paid half, and she was, you know, basically earning minimum wage and was unable to pay the other half. Her original bill was about $32,000. By the time she went to court, it was increasing at the rate of 10% a year, plus there were attorney's fees and costs, and eventually she was on the hook for about $62,000. And this is a woman who is earning $240 a week.
Okay, but doesn't the hospital have a right to be paid?
If someone can pay their bills, of course. But the problem is that the hospital actually has a considerable reserve of funds for mm-hmm. free care. And at present, this is more than $37 million.
Hmm. Why wouldn't the hospital resort to that?
They've made the application process very difficult. You know, instead, they found another way to get the money, which is to use incredibly aggressive debt collection practices.
Well, the state of Connecticut has lowered interest rates to 5%. The hospital has seemingly indicated, urged by the American Hospital Association, that it will modify or moderate its billing practices. Why are you still suing?
The fact remains that there are probably a couple of thousand people who actually paid money that they should not have paid, and their lives were, you know, drastically changed as a result of having to deal with this, whether it's being unable to refinance their homes or, in fact, to have to sell their homes to pay off liens or, you know, having their wages garnished for an extended period of time. And so until they're made whole again, this won't actually be resolved.
What do you think would have happened to these plaintiffs if you hadn't taken up their case, presumably for free? Would they have had access to legal help?
Almost certainly not. Often the individual amounts are not high enough for a private attorney to take them on, and a lot of legal issues are very complex.
So, Andrew, just to finish up, where does it all stand now legally? What happens next?
We have been in negotiation with the hospital and given them a summary of our claims and our legal arguments, and they haven't gotten back to us. So at present, we are representing individual clients and revising a complaint to file as a class action.
Is this a widespread problem in the U.S.?
Obviously, access to health care in this country is approaching a crisis point. And this is just one example of how it works. One of the reasons why we can do this is because, in a way, because Yale New Haven Hospital has such strong resources for free care, we feel very strongly that as a nonprofit hospital with a charitable mission, it should be working to make a difference.
Yale law student Andrew Sackett. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
You're welcome.
Yale New Haven Hospital says it will comment only once a lawsuit is filed. Well, turning now to a happier take on health care, ask some people what they'd like for Christmas, and chances are a fair number will fall back on that old chestnut, just so long as I have my health. Well, over the upcoming holiday season, some people are actually going to get something pretty close to that: free health care. People who can't afford health insurance will be able to receive eye surgery at no cost, courtesy of the McGowan Eye Care Center. Joining us on the line is Dr. Bernard McGowan, who thought the whole thing up as director at the McGowan Eye Care Center in Framingham, Massachusetts. And, Doctor, welcome.
Good to be here.
Tell us about this program.
Well, for the past 8 years now, we've been doing free surgery for people who can't afford or who don't have health insurance.
Hmm. How come?
Well, this is a wealthy country, and for people to be blind for no other reason than the fact that they're falling between the cracks in the healthcare system, I've tried to work with, for instance, Medicaid. We do free surgery for people who can't. The state of Massachusetts doesn't allow surgery centers to bill for their facility fees, so we do those for nothing. And we operate in Honduras every few years for people who can't afford health care. And I thought that there must be a large number of people in this 44 million in this country who actually just are blind because they can't afford it.
And it just bugged you. You wanted to do something about it.
That's right.
How much does an average eye surgery, if you can calculate that, cost?
Somewhere in the order of $2,000 to $2,500 if you include all the preoperative testing and the measuring. This is a fee that's set by Medicare. That's what we're paid for most of these operations.
I see. Are you saving people's sight or restoring their sight?
Well, there are a whole variety of things that we do. We don't do cosmetic or refractive surgery. This is for people who actually have serious eye diseases. And so over the years, we've done probably somewhere in the order of 100, 120 operations, everything from mostly cataracts, but a certain number of glaucoma operations, diabetic lasers, macular degeneration, retinal tears and holes, eye muscle operations, a wide variety of things that that I do and that my two associates who are retinal specialists do.
Dr. McGowan, if there's a listener out there that is hearing this in a special way because they have a problem you might be able to help them with, what should they do?
Well, they should call and make an appointment as soon as they can get in so that they can get on our surgical schedule for the day before Christmas. Actually, I guess it's the 23rd Tuesday. And we'll put them on the schedule. We've always had, except for 1 year, we've always had unused time. So I encourage people to believe this story. It really is true. Mm-hmm. And we have the experience and we have the team. And most people don't want to be operated on right before Christmas. So we have extra time in our schedule. And we're just so happy that we're able to do something here.
What do you get out of it, Doc? You don't make any money on it.
Well, the thing is that just to have people know that this is available, I get that warm, fuzzy feeling that we're making a difference. And, despite the message that seems to be out there these days, everything is not in economic terms.
Dr. Bernard McGowan is director at the McGowan Eye Center in Framingham, Massachusetts. Dr. McGowan, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Still to come.
Well, for more information on the free eye care program and the number for the McGowan Center, please go to our website, here-now.org. Robin?
And now, still to come, murder mystery writer Elizabeth Peters and her thing about ancient Egypt. You're listening to Here and Now.
Well, as we heard a bit earlier in the program, there's nothing new about women wearing all sorts of hats in the business world, from the secretarial pool to the executive suite. But it might surprise you to learn how many women are wearing hard hats and doing a lot of other jobs usually done by men. Marcy Albahar Nussbaum is a lawyer and freelance writer who wrote an article about this for the New York Times, and Marcy joins us now. Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Bill.
Marcy, women doing jobs usually associated with men. What's going on?
Well, what's going on? The impetus for my writing this story was that I encountered a few women who had started these handy women referral businesses. Mm-hmm. And they were starting these businesses because they had clients who were asking them specifically if they could recommend female contractors for various jobs.
Why would people be asking for female contractors?
The reasons that came up are kind of interesting. Some women live alone and aren't comfortable having a man come into their home to do work.
Mm-hmm.
Women seem to feel that men can be patronizing on these kinds of jobs, and they want to talk to someone who will treat it as a collaborative process rather than talk down to them. They've also said that women tend to be neater on the job. Some of these things sound stereotypical, but oddly, they were coming up again and again in the conversations I had with these women.
So what fields are women pushing into that they weren't into 5 or 10 years ago as much?
Well, one of the biggest examples is car repair and auto mechanic shops. One of the reasons behind that is that there's been huge increases in the number of women who are customers in auto repair shops, and the auto repair shops are catering to women's needs. One car chain, CarStar, which is the country's largest collision repair franchise, is reaching out to women with lots of details, offices rather than shops where they talk about their needs, spotless waiting rooms with wingback chairs and scented candles, trying to get away from the grimy garage feeling. Home Depot has even recognized this. Home Depot is offering do-it-herself workshops where they've trained over 100,000 women in all kinds of skills, from woodworking to retiling a bathroom to all kinds of home projects and projects that can be done in a commercial setting.
Marcy, you also see a real surge of women running big operations, construction firms, for example, in the past few years.
Yes, that is true. The Center for Women's Business Research did a recent study, and women-owned firms in non-traditional fields have increased up to 18% over the last 5 years. In traditional fields, only up to 14%, and construction is one of those fields.
Women have had to push through so many barriers. Resistance to this sort of thing?
Oh, there certainly is. I think one of the largest areas in the people I talked to that I saw resistance is in the apprenticeship training programs for certain of the blue-collar trades. Many of those programs where you'd think these women come out of only have 2 to 3% women in their programs. And these things are where places like law schools and business schools were over 25 years ago. Mm. So coming out of the ranks that are the traditional training pools, it's a tough, tough place for women.
What would you say to a woman who might want some work done on her apartment or her home or her car, but she wants it done by a woman? How do you go about finding someone to do that?
I would say get on Google and Google in female handy women like I did and see what you can come up with in your area. There are also many local women's organizations, women in business organizations that would be good stops for referrals.
Marcy Alberher Nussbaum wrote a piece for the New York Times about women doing jobs usually associated with men. She's also a lawyer. Thanks, Marcy.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Ramses, Nefertiti, Tutankhamun. The names evoke images of ancient Egypt. Mystery writer Elizabeth Peters understands the allure of Egypt. She's written over 60 books, but her most popular feature Egyptologist and amateur detective Amelia Peabody Emerson, a character who discovers ancient wonders and solves crimes while excavating in Egypt during the Victorian era. Recently, a group of Elizabeth Peters fans gathered at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts to explore the museum's Egyptian collection, celebrating its 100th anniversary, and to meet Peters and talk about their mutual love of the author and her main character, Amelia.
I love Amelia's spirit, her independent spirit. I love the Egyptology, and I love the relationship of all the characters to each other.
A sense of humor. The Egyptian background. She handles it all so beautifully. She truly does. She's a master storyteller.
I'm a huge fan, and I've been reading her since I was in high school, and I won't say how many years ago that was.
What about Amelia Peabody appeals to you?
Oh, she's great. She's a woman with a mind of her own, and she's the equal of any man in the archaeological field. She's great.
Well, like Amelia, author Elizabeth Peters loves Egyptology. She trained in the subject at the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute. Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa took the opportunity to tour the collection with Peters and asked her when her love of Egypt began.
I think possibly one of the first things, my great aunt, everyone should have a great aunt who drags them to museums, whether they want to go or not. She took me to the Oriental Institute Museum, and that was when I first saw Egyptian art, and I just fell head over heels.
Never gotten rid of it since?
Never gotten rid of it since, no.
Well, here we are at a museum, and can you tell me a little bit about, well, something we're seeing?
Wow. This is, of course, one of the best museums in the world for its Egyptian art collection, I should say. Second only to the Met in the United States, if that. And this is the Old Kingdom Room. And it is here that the museum has its greatest treasures, I think. Many of these are from excavations that the museum funded back in the teens and 20s at Giza. And in those days, the laws about sharing antiquities were much more lax than they are today. I mean, none of this is illegal. It was given to the museum by the head of the Service des Antiquités. But they were much more generous about it, so they've got some pieces here that most museums would kill for.
What's interesting is that Amelia herself has some very decided opinions about taking antiquities out of Egypt, too.
Oh, yes, she does. Well, it's partly jealousy. Actually, George Reisner, who is the man responsible for these excavations and one of the great archaeologists of all time, worked with the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and Harvard. It was a joint expedition. So I have Reisner in some of the books, and she's hideously jealous of him because he's digging out all the mastabas she wants to dig out.
Do you want to just walk around and look at some?
Yeah, I can just mention a couple of the things that I think are very exciting in this room. There are so many of them. As I said, this is all Old Kingdom. This group on the left is one of Reisner's that he brought back. It's a royal pair statue of King Menkaure and his wife, his queen. And it is typical of the work of this period. It's this beautiful, glossy surface, as you can see. It makes you want to stroke it, but you can't because they'll arrest you. But that came from Giza, and it is, in my opinion, one of the finest statues ever to come out of Egypt. That's gorgeous. The one next to it is a triad, the king with two goddesses who are protecting him. There's Hathor in the middle and goddess of the, I think she's the gnome of Thebes, Waset. And look at the male physique in all these statues. You wouldn't really know whether that's what he looked like. But that's the way they wanted to look, and that's the way they showed themselves. And it would suit any modern lady would gasp over that physique, don't you think?
What do you think is it about Egypt that really holds people's attention? I mean, it's been 100 years that this collection is here, mm-hmm. and people are still excited about it.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that, and this is a very superficial analysis, but I think it's a combination of the exotic and the familiar. It's different enough to be fascinating, the mummies, the beautiful jewelry, and so forth. And yet, there is such humanity in these people. You recognize so many human traits in them. They enjoyed life. They enjoyed the taverns where they drank too much beer. And they fooled around with other people's wives sometimes. And their neighbors gossiped about them, wrote nasty letters. But then you can look at something like this, another one of my favorite pieces, which is a beaded dress. And that was found with all the threads rotted. All those little bitty beads are strung on threads. And when it was discovered, the beads had just tumbled into a mass. And I don't know the name of the wonderful woman here who put that back together again, but I'm sure glad I didn't have to do it. But you see, it's a very erotic-looking sort of dress. It just has these wide straps over the breasts, which are also beads, attached to the collar, and the beautiful colors, the faience, the pale greenish blue and gold, and then this network of teeny tiny beads with a little fringe of more beads. I mean, I think it's just a gorgeous dress, and if I were younger and slimmer and if I could get my hands on it, I'd wear it maybe over something else.
The treasures are here and they're wonderful that we can see them. It's very important to the characters of your book that the treasures stay in Egypt, mm-hmm. and are there. How do you find that balance, do you think?
I find it very difficult to balance, and I think Amelia does, too. You can look at the Acropolis reliefs, which are in the British Museum, and they're stunning, and they're gorgeous, and the Greeks want them back. But the stuff that was left on the Acropolis, I think the Turks used the building for a powder magazine. There's nothing left of what was there. So you can say that you're preserving them, in a sense, by removing them from a war zone or an unsettled zone. Plus, they're more accessible to different people. Not everybody can travel to Egypt.
I'm just curious. There's all the stuff here. Do you also like the mummies downstairs?
Oh, they're fun, but I feel a little self-conscious about them. The Cairo Museum now has some of the royal mummies back on exhibit, and there's an unholy fascination in looking at these things. You know, 3,000-4,000 years old. This was the king of Egypt. But he doesn't look the way he did. I would not care to be exhibited looking like that. Let's put it that way. Let's wander down here, if we may. We'll find some of my favorite animals. They did animals with great charm.
There's one cat thing right
That's
there.
It. That's the kitty. I love that kitty.
Oh, it's lovely. It's got the ears. It's got the ears.
Yes, the Egyptian cats had big ears. At least the originals did. You see, there are a number of cats around. The cats were sacred to Bastet, who was also associated with Hathor. And so you see a lot of cats in Egyptian art. But I love this particular one because it's a relief, and it's in profile, which you don't see. And the delicacy of the carving, the whiskers, those great big ears, and that look of lofty disdain that all cats have, I think it's just gorgeous. You know, people go racing through these galleries and they don't see things like this. This is one of the ones I'd steal. A friend of mine and I had a game we used to play. If you could steal 50 objects from any museum in the world, which 50 would you steal? And it's a terrible struggle, you know, to restrict it to 50.
Do you find that you're becoming more like Amelia as you get older?
Oh, yes. That's the terrifying thing about it. I used to be very mealy-mouthed and polite. And it's partly getting older, because as you get older, you realize I don't have to go knuckling around to people, you know. I might as well enjoy my last 10 years and tell everybody off the way I feel like it. But I think maybe she has influenced me, and that's a rather encouraging thought. I don't want her to be ashamed of me.
Mystery writer Elizabeth Peters with Here Now producer Emiko Tamagawa. Peters' newest book in the Amelia Peabody series is called Amelia Peabody's Egypt.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Metzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
The Medicare bill adds $400 billion to a federal budget leading economists say is way out of control.
And Chef Kathy Gunst with What Else? Thanksgiving Tips.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.